This is Ladson Hinton, October 8th, 1999, Dreams Through a Glass Darkly.
Ladson, we always enjoy having you, and without further ado, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you.
Testing.
Well, it's always a wonderful opportunity to force myself to collect my thoughts and start to examine all sorts of things that I take for granted if I'm invited here. I've written also quite a bit on shame, and it's always the shame factor. It really gets me to work that I might totally disgrace myself when I come in, so that stimulates my creativity. Back there? Okay. Just if my voice drops down, sometimes when I talk, it sort of drops down, let me know.
Actually, we are recording, but...
At least... Should I get this over here for recording? Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Okay. So I would really like to thank the Jung Society and all the people who work so much to bring these events to us. I think it's so easy to take for granted all the work they do, and without the Jung Society, I think this would be a very different and much less psychological community. So I'd like to thank them very much. But I did have a hard time pulling my thoughts together on this topic because there's so much. I deal with dreams every day, and God knows how many dreams. Before going on, too, I want to mention a few things about visions. From the psychological point of view, I consider visions as spontaneous eruptions of imagery, often accompanied by intense emotion. The word visions has lots of meaning for people, but I think a spontaneous eruption of imagery into consciousness accompanied by a lot of emotion. These are on a continuum with reverie, fantasy, daydreams, dreams, apparitions, and body fantasies. Profound experiences such as visions can, by comparison and relating, provide insight into more usual and everyday experiences. Visions differ from delusions and hallucinations in that the person undergoing them is aware that they are a separate category of reality and not applicable to outer life in any literal sense. They are usually perceived as stemming from the inner world of the person or from God. They may reframe the individual behaves and relates towards self and world, but there is not a great deal of projection onto the world in a literal sense. At Agnew State Hospital in California during the 1970s, there was an experimental treatment unit for schizophrenia. In this special project, inspired by the work of John Perry, psychotic people were treated with art therapy and talking, with no medication. Many of these patients, and I filled in for John Perry part of the time on this ward when he was on vacation, they were flooded with wild waves of emotionally laden imagery. It was a very wild place, you know, no medication, just talking to people and working with art and so forth. But one of the most interesting findings, and they did long-term research follow-ups, Julian Silverman, I think, did most of these, was that the patients who perceived their images as inner, belonging to them, had a much better prognosis. Those who externalized and blamed things on, the commies or, the devil or, whatever, something out there, had a much worse prognosis. Perhaps some of these overwhelming occurrences, perhaps there were embryonic visions in the container of the individual was just too weak to translate them into some form that could be related to self and to world. It probably just the vessel sometimes is too weak. It appears that the vital energy of life seeks incarnation and is sometimes not too considerate about the way it enters individual lives. I see a lot of nods. not all of us have the immense strength of a Brüder Klaus, and that's what separates saints from the rest of us. Everyday people with visions may be judged crazy for a time, and indeed may think of themselves as crazy. They frequently do. But eventually the experiences can be assimilated in a personally and culturally useful way with many people. They may elaborate themselves then over the lifetime of a person, as was the case with Brüder Klaus. Indeed, according to von Franz, Jung called Brüder Klaus the patron saint of psychotherapy because of the stark model of transformation his life showed. The nature of his visionary process is my main interest. I will follow Jung's description most closely. Brüder Klaus's religious experience culminated in the so-called Trinity vision, which he painted or had painted on the wall of his cell. It's still preserved in the parish church at Soxon. It began as a very simple wheel mandala divided into six parts. Later, it was elaborated in a more complex way, and I will show you some slides of these after the break. As Jung described his Brüder Klaus's original experience, in his ecstasy was revealed to Brüder Klaus a sight so terrible that his own countenance was changed by it. So much so, indeed, that people were terrified and felt afraid of him. Brüder Klaus's original vision was something other. The popular depiction, the paintings later seen by pilgrims, was in fact a later translation of the original vision into a more differentiated symbolic form that was religiously and culturally syntonic. This later expression was in fact heavily influenced by Brüder Klaus's study of an illustrated devotional book by a German mystic of the time. Brüder Klaus is quoted as saying, "Grosses hat der Herr an mir getan." My good friend Peter Elting translated this for me. My German is not good enough. He translated this as, "God has done an immense deed with me." "Grosses hat der Herr an mir getan." Also, if you're interested, there is a Brüder Klaus website. A lot of this is on there with some nice pictures and stuff, and you can see where he lived. And it's kind of fun. Wolfram, a scholar and younger contemporary, wrote, "All who came to him were filled with terror at first glance. As the cause of this, he himself used to say that he had seen a piercing light resembling a human face. At the sight of it, he feared his heart would burst into little pieces. Therefore, overcome with terror, he instantly turned his face away and fell to the ground. And that was the reason his face was now so terrible to others." Another person of the era wrote, "I wish to tell you of a vision which appeared to him in the sky on a night when the stars were shining and he stood in prayer and contemplation. He saw the head of a human figure with a terrifying face full of wrath and threats." The main point I want to make here is the reality of the overpowering energy that came into his psyche, the reality of that energy. It seemed to defy any division into the differentiated opposites of normal thought or doctrine. It was ecstasy, but it was also terrible, so far away from what the mind can encompass that it took a long time to be translated into some form that could be communicated at all in a usable way. Although he left his family and became a religious hermit, as I said, he was of great service to society, both as a sage and healer, and by helping to peacefully unify his home region. I think Jung was especially taken with the figure of Brüder Klaus because he identified very much with his struggle, having had his own intensely disturbing dreams and visions and having his own sanity and doubt, both his own doubt and by many others for a long time. Jung's emotional upheaval, of course, was the basis of his lifetime of creativity. These explosive eruptions from another realm, from the unconscious, the self, God, O, das Es, kundalini, or what have you, or emotional and sometimes violent contacts with a something that seems to be the source of life. It appears to demand incarnation and expression, even at times at the apparent expense of destroying individual lives. Because it can seem quite blind to ethics, the individual must often resist the urge toward impulsive behavior and take a stand for basic human values. As Jung noted with humble wit, in alchemy there is on the one hand the divine stone, which is the philosopher's stone or grail, and on the other there was the divine water, which happened to be sulfuric acid. The philosopher's stone, the goal of all of our desires, inspires us. On the other hand, the sulfuric acid removes the impurities that would make it impossible to connect to the stone. Our longing lures us on. Our terror cooks us down to our essence. This alchemical parallel illustrates the intertwining of terror and ecstasy in the experience of the sheer unknown. Brudeklaas's original vision certainly can be described as through a glass darkly. It was profound, dramatic, terrifying, perhaps life-threatening. It demanded expression in his life and in concrete images. The dreams and eruptions we experience in everyday life are different in intensity, but not in kind. Emotions and strange moods come into us. Like visions, their source is also unknown, and they also seem to demand relationship and articulation. We struggle to decipher, integrate, and express the energies we take in the ongoing process of life. The dream is an experience between sheer unconsciousness and consciousness. Visions are a more dramatic penetration of one realm into the other. If we can let ourselves see it, our dreams and everyday experiences have a strange and dynamic quality, not so far from the visions of a Brudeklaas. What prevents us from knowing this so much of the time is fear and terror of the unknown. Our original helplessness in the face of the universe fills us with anxiety when we look at it too clearly. We tend to want to turn our gaze away. So there is anxiety and terror at the basis of our most creative experiences. When the vitality of the unknown touches us, we feel at least a bit of terror, and sometimes a lot. Dreams can be seen as a part of the struggle to transform human unconsciousness and thereby transform a small particle of the unconsciousness of the universe, or some people say of the dark side of God, the dark unconscious side of God. Emotions pour through us daily, and we try to cope and create out of the small and large disruptions they cause. We don't pay any attention unless they're disruptions. The emotional intensity of Brudeklaas's visions was what struck others so strongly. Emotion is the energy of life, and the effort to contain emotions and translate them into humanly accessible symbolic forms goes on continuously. Dreaming is a crucial part of the process of containment and translation. It's only slowly and painfully that human beings have developed the capacity for reflection and what we call consciousness. In Paleolithic cave art, one can glimpse some of the beginnings of this process. By radiocarbon testing, the recently discovered Chauvet cave in the Ardèche region of southeastern France is at least 30,000 years old. My wife and I twice visited some of these caves and went through some of them extensively. The caves where the Cro-Magnon actually lived were shallow places near the surface. The places where they painted weren't where they lived. In the vast dark cathedrals within the earth, near what must have been the symbolic source of everything for them, they worshipfully painted for millennia. Their paintings come across like dreams or visions. The amount of time and effort required for their creation gives witness to their profound symbolic importance to the community. I've been honored to have others share thousands and thousands of dreams with me and have gained a very deep respect for the emerging mystery. Anytime we truly meet another person, there is an aspect of mystery and dread. Each time I see a new patient, I still feel some of that. And when I don't feel a tinge of that, I should stop practicing. Dreams are not merely inner. The process of dreaming is part of the process of relationship with the other, capital O. This is both the human other, the other in the human, or at times the pure otherness of the cosmos itself. Dreams can bring home these dimensions of existence to us, in that as our experience of depth increases, so does the capacity for empathic relationship increase. Awareness of the deep value of other people expands accordingly. Here, I must insert a caveat. If dreams are taken literally or as a sign of the movements of consciousness, reflecting about dreams and the limitations of human consciousness, a version of the allegory of the cave came to me. I saw that we are like beings in a vast cave with just little flashlights. And if you've ever been in a huge cave without very much light, you can appreciate how that really feels. At first, we think the world is like the tiny perimeter that we can light up with our little light. And then we begin to shine our lights around and we see shifting shapes and endless vast distances. And we can't see very much at all or very far. Reactively, we tend to cling in terror to those around us, thinking that, well, someone must know. Eventually, we realize that they, like us, also know very little. When you move to explore the outer fringes as best you can, the shapes shift in endless perspectives. And if you share what you've seen with others, though, you can know a little more. The common human plight brings us closer together. But your light, our light, remains small and finite. Dreams can help you assimilate the meaning of what you do encounter and to focus your light and help you keep perspective. In this vein, Jung said, the unconscious is an autonomous psychic entity. Any efforts to drill it are only apparently successful and moreover are harmful. It is and remains beyond the realm of subjective arbitrary control, in a realm where nature and her secrets can neither be improved upon or perverted, or where we can listen but not meddle. And further, indeed, it seems as if all the personal entanglements and dramatic changes of fortune that make up the intensity of life were nothing but hesitations, timid shrinkings, almost like petty complications and meticulous excuses for not facing the finality of this strange and uncanny process. Often one has the impression that the personal psyche is running around this central point like a shy animal, at once fascinated and frightened, always in flight, and yet steadily drawing near. Dreams illustrate our endless attempts to approach and comprehend the mystery into which we are born. As Wilfred Bion once said, we are like a stripe on the back of a tiger. We are on the way to somewhere, but faith is required. Dreams give us a little window of insight upon the enigmatic process of life that we ride. Now to speak a little bit from the developmental point of view, we emerge on the stage of life helpless and dependent in a strange surrounding we can't comprehend. For the balance of our lives, we survive as we can, as infants and children, and slowly attempt to understand our situation and create meaning out of it. Our desire pushes us to connect to others and to the otherness of the wider universe. The brain is the most crucial piece of equipment in this task, with its 100 billion neurons and trillions of synapses. Only a very complex brain could contain and elaborate such things as the visions of Bruder Klaus. As described by Alan Hobson and others, the earliest shaping of brain and personality seems dependent upon REM sleep and dreaming. REM sleep, or REM sleep, refers to the stage of sleep and typified by rapid eye movements. REM. Most of you probably know about that. The human infant sleeps 16 or 17 hours a day, and half of this sleep is REM sleep, in contrast to 20% or so in the adult. This is also the part of sleep during which dreams occur. In the infant, dramatic and complex muscle movements also occur during REM sleep, whereas the muscle movement is totally paralyzed in the adult. This only happens in the infant. Very complex muscle movements. They are elaborate and things the infant could not consciously command. In dreaming sleep, the infant apparently explores, rehearses, and begins to integrate its innate motor capacity as well as whatever emotional currents are passing through its tiny psyche. All mammalian species manifest some variant of these patterns and seem to require REM sleep and quite possibly dreaming for their development. The brain doubles in size during the first 2 years of life through myelination, but the total number of brain cells is pruned by 50 to 75%. There is a sort of Darwinian survival at work in early brain development. Some cell groups survive, and some patterns emerge, and some don't. According to Alan Shore, this pruning process seems to be largely influenced by the mother-child bond, which creates phasic, biochemical, and hormonal responses in the infant's brain itself during certain open periods of development. The brain is molded by its innate activity, along with the attuned or misattuned gaze and emotions of the caring other. Brain development, of course, is not complete until later adolescence and continues to a degree throughout life. It's always a good thing I like to think about these days. During all this time, the brain is dreaming away. All these changes, the brain is dreaming away, this dynamic, ongoing process of shifting and change, and the very structure of the brain, not to speak of the taking in emotion and beginning to think in little pieces of words or symbols. It's interesting to note that predatory animals have longer sleep cycles than those who are prey. For instance, the cat family typically sleeps 16 to 18 hours a day, and just lying back on their backs in the savanna. Presumably they're dreaming peacefully much of that time. Sleep cycles are shorter in herbivore and other prey animals. These animals cannot afford to rest easily and remain vulnerable for very long. It's too dangerous. One more than wonders whether that's why we tend to have trouble sleeping when we are so under stress. Do we begin to act like chronically terrified animals surrounded by predators, unable to rest? Is this symptom the vestige of some ancient fight-or-flight pattern? It's very clear that REM sleep and dreams are crucial to life from the very beginning. The structure and formation of the brain seems dependent upon those processes. The brain continues to evolve throughout life, though at a slower pace. REM sleep and dreams continue their crucial developmental function throughout the life cycle, helping shape the magnificent adult brain that is capable of such things as visions, poetry, romantic love, math, science, and so forth. Damasio and others have shown the brain's astounding capacity for unconscious judgment and perception. Most of the ongoing decisions we make don't reach the level of conscious thinking. I mean, I don't think about whether I'm going to wave my hand in the air or look around, or, you know, we don't really think about what we do most of the time. They're based in an emotional evaluative part of the brain, mainly the right side of the brain. As a matter of fact, it's obvious that a creature that stopped to think all the time would not survive very long. As a matter of fact, people who get tremendously obsessive-compulsive don't do too well. Dreaming plays an important part in this somewhat automatic but dynamic adaptation. Whether we remember our dreams or not, they go on integrating our daily experiences anyway and synthesizing new possibilities. They function as a very special and intense dimension of the ongoing creation of the self. Self, little s. In REM sleep, and especially in the dreaming state, our motor output is blocked. If you've ever awakened in a heavy sleep and can't move, you know, your motor output is blocked, and that can be kind of terrifying temporarily sometimes when you wake up out of a heavy dreaming sleep. And the sensory output from the outer world is cut off. There's a sensory block. You can sleep through anything kind of when you're in REM sleep. We become a sort of isolated container in that way. Motor activity cut off, input cut off. So you can't act out and you can't take in. You're just in there with yourself, so to speak. So you become an isolated container during dreaming. And the biochemical balance of the brain shifts in ways that are still being explored. In a sense, we return to the primal swamp of creation, in my fantasy, assimilating the day's stresses, connecting memories, adjusting the fantastically complex neural nets that make up our brains and cells. Sleep and dreams are an incubator for the assimilation of experiences and for experimentation with new possibilities for being. It seems possible that the human brain retains the memories of all human evolution, perhaps even including the cosmic origins. The human mind may also retain, it seems to me, a deep sense of the times when its ancestors, our tiny ancestors, those little tiny marsupials that we came from somewhere, were for endless millennia prey for larger and more violent organisms. It may be that the paranoid qualities of the human species originated in that primeval time when we were prey for other more powerful creatures. That may be the basis of many of our more violent and shadowy propensities, some of the more unfortunate qualities of the human species. These show up all the time in dreams and fantasies, not to speak of daily life and news headlines. We all feel at times like prey, needing to survive at all costs. Dreams constantly cope with such dark phantoms. On the other hand, we also survive by cooperation. Charity and love are in the brain too. Eros, agape, thanatos, fear, desire. These are also deeply rooted in the human brain psyche. In our dreams, as in our conscious life, we endlessly try to connect people and things that may seem logically unrelated. It's no mistake that Jung named his last great work Mysterium Conjunctionis, or as I call it, mysterious connectings. Our desire leads us to endlessly attempt to connect, and our dreams show us our failures as well as our times of transcendence. You're all right back there? I start talking so loud, I start feeling like a preacher up here, really. Yeah, brother. Well, it's a very nice congregation here today. Anybody have a hat? All of our lives could be written about as a struggle to translate the raw matter of evolutionary energy into individual living form. For the remainder of this lecture, I would like to tell you the story of a man that vividly illustrates such a struggle. It's from many years ago and far away. I deeply thank this person for having given me permission to share his story and his dreams with you, and I trust that you will all treat these confidences with respect and discretion. This man, whom I will call Bill, was about 36 years old when he first came to my office. He was edgy and extremely critical from the time he walked in the door. He had been in psychoanalysis for about 5 years before and felt it had not been of any help. He'd been on the couch 4 or 5 times a week. Then he had briefly consulted another therapist with a totally different point of view and felt that was a failure, and he was angry and critical and dissatisfied and only felt forced to come to see me because he felt so terrible. But even at this first meeting, his underlying terror and vulnerability were quite clearly present. I could feel them, no matter what he said. His fear of the unknown was clearly extreme, and he could in no way, though, acknowledge that in words. Any mention of it would be extreme attacks. I think he felt so shamed and terrified if I would even mention it right from the start that there's no way you could talk about it. To speak of it is to begin to face it, and when you speak of something and name it, then you start to look at it. And he happened to be a therapist himself, and it was also clear that he used all of his training, and he was a smart fellow, to prevent a working therapeutic alliance. A real working relationship, assenting to that, would have meant giving up control and entering new territory. His past experiences in family or in therapy seemed to give him little inner ground for hope. When I would try to empathetically acknowledge his emotional position, Bill would answer such comments sarcastically with responses like, "Well, that's a big help. I pay you all this money to hear that crap." This is very typical. He made me work very hard, and I often dreaded the twice-weekly sessions. I better have a little water now. Something in him seemed to want to destroy my best attempts at connection. At times, I indeed felt a bit of terror and aloneness, which grew when I was with him. Often I felt so terribly cut off from him and useless that I felt on the verge of a kind of rageful anger myself. I began to realize then, after I reflected on it and talked to a couple of friends in kind of consultation, that in fact I was feeling his world was inside me. I was really feeling how he felt, cut off, alone, isolated, terribly anxious, on the verge of fits of rage. I knew reflexly, which I had sort of known, but it came more explicit, that only speaking simply, not with any complex intellectual sorts of interpretations, would provide any hope at all. It's like Parsifal and the wounded Fisher King. You have to speak directly and without the guile of professional knowledge and training, or healing in the end can't take place, for sure. The general background was that Bill was an only child in an Irish Catholic family. His mother, who had died some years before of a heart attack, had been a school teacher. He was born when she was in her late 30s, not having married until late in life for her generation. His father, still living at the time I began to see him, was a severe alcoholic with a violent temper. Although he did not beat Bill, but he was just very abusive verbally. Bill was a very good boy who came home after school to an empty house. He said his mother was usually tired and depressed when she finally came home from teaching, and he spent a lot of energy trying to pick her up, raise her spirits, and so forth. He described the mood of the house as like a mausoleum. The mausoleum became a major motif of our work. Early on, Bill latched onto the idea of becoming a priest. He would please his mother and become a very different man than his father. Therefore, he went into the minor seminary as a teenager. He had a great deal of interest in and fantasy about girls. It was some secret dates. He did rebel a little bit, but he had no concrete sexual experiences while in the seminary. After several years of study, this possible ordination loomed in the future more clearly, he became more and more suffocated and panicky. He was edgy and resentful toward the seminary authorities and thought constantly about sex. Finally, he left the seminary and went to graduate school to become a therapist. "My mother trained me for my career," he said. This is true of most of us, I think. A difficult choice because he felt it would kill his mother. Indeed, she died a couple of years later while he was still in grad school, and he still wondered if he had caused her death. He dated a few women and about a year later married an attractive woman who proved to be very unstable. She had seemed intelligent and engaging before marriage but became more and more volatile after marriage when they finally moved in together. She was finally hospitalized for an apparent psychosis and later after a suicide attempt. In between, there were multiple trips to emergency rooms. This is, of course, all before I saw him. Bill became afraid to express any feelings or make any demands. He was working in a clinic and dreaded to come home for fear of what he might find. It was the mausoleum, but worse, he said. Bill was totally intimidated and felt powerless. His wife would not continue with any psychiatrist or marriage counselor, but would fly into rages at suggestions of it. Finally, he'd separated from her. "It wasn't the shrinks who helped me," he said. "All they did was feed me interpretations, and I just stayed in the same miserable place. And now a seminary buddy of mine finally told me I had to bite the bullet or settle for a living hell. He was right, and I did it. When he came to see me, it was because of severe depression with all the textbook symptoms. Though separated, he felt unable to file for divorce, and his ex-wife constantly called and raged at him for hours on the telephone. She demanded money, and he would listen helplessly. He would send her money. It was almost impossible for him to say no, but he was able to stay physically separated if he paid her off. He was beginning to spend some time with another woman, but that increased his sense of guilt, failure, and shame about the failed marriage. Bill was severely depressed. He felt empty and unalive most of the time, although I generally sensed vitality in him that he did not feel himself. I resisted becoming overreactive to his critical defensiveness that I've mentioned, and he slowly let down his guard and began to trust me a little. He was sometimes able to talk more openly about his fear and despair. At other times, he lapsed back into the typical angry defensiveness, saying I'd probably thought he was just a hopeless psychotic like his wife, and that I would probably slap him into a hospital if he told me how he really felt. I usually responded in a simple way, commenting on how frightening it was for him to trust, knowing that his past relationships had made it difficult to trust, and I also said that underneath I knew that he still longed to trust, despite what he sometimes said. He really did not want to be alone in the world with his fear and terror. And over time, he resisted less and less, became less vituperative when I would say such things. I represented many things to him, but most especially the unknown that he feared. He reflexively fended me off out of a sort of nameless dread. He felt that if he could control our relationship and defeat the analytic process, he could control his terror. Nothing new or unknown could occur then. Could he enter into true dialogue with me and with the unknown, or would he end in defensive psychic deadness of a chronic sort? Bill's father died during the first months of analysis. He felt relief on the one hand, but on the other a lot of grief for what hadn't been between them. It also brought back sad memories of family life and of his mother's death. He reported no dreams for several months, but he trusted me. As he trusted me more, he revealed a terrifying inner experience. He called it the black hole. This was an inner, partially somatic entity deep inside. You point to this. It was just there, almost impossible to describe, and felt deep in his gut. It was reminiscent of Bruder Klaus's overpowering vision. Bill could hardly bear to even talk about it at first. Just to glance at it or try to look with me a little evoked a shudder of terror and renewed defensiveness and terrible anxiety. He would cringe with a look of horror, as if he needed immediately to avert his own inner gaze. At times, too, he would diminish it, saying it was meaningless or just meant he was psychotic. I had to struggle. In fact, this experience was, convey how intense it was. I had a tendency to not want to look at it myself. It was recoil. At first, he described the black hole as nothing, like a void, or like something sucking up his life and destroying him. "I can't stand to talk about this crazy shit anymore, Hinton," he would anxiously and accusingly insist. But in fact, that was just what he felt impelled to talk about. He didn't want to talk about anything else in a certain way, and he began to trust me, as I say. It became clear that the black hole was not nothing, but indeed was an extremely powerful something. We would spend several minutes sort of gazing at it together in a sort of quiet reverie. No personal associations came, such as the void of parental love, like the blackness could be an emptiness, a negativity of love or anger or something. There were no personal associations. It seemed to be an entity in itself. He acknowledged more often that the black hole indeed was extremely powerful, and it was this power that he feared. Not only was it not nothing, it was too alive. Over several months, as we got closer to this strange entity, Bill became more anxious and suicidal. I received several calls, including a couple late at night. He needed to know I was really there. He was on the edge, and the outcome was by no means certain. After about a year of work together, he reported his first big dream. He had not really had any dreams as such until this time. It seemed to have any symbolic meaning, just little pieces of very minimal. But this was his first big dream. It's a long one, and I'll read it slowly. "I'm in Hong Kong, then on a trip to Red China." This was 20 years ago. "It's a backpacking trip to see the sarcophagus. I'm with some guys. We have to sneak across the border. There are some warning shots from guards, and we have to scamper up the hill. Then we cross a desert to an underground passage. We come to a room where the sarcophagus is supposed to be. The room is crowded with people. I see some porcelain and granite bulls with red horns. The bulls pull all my attention rather than the sarcophagi. I want to take a picture. There are people in my way, and I get frustrated. My tour guide named Mike says it's time to go back to Hong Kong. I have to take a leak first. There's a long row of Johns. A guy is there with two bare-breasted women, and he yells at me to stop looking, that he's going to kick the shit out of me. I knock him against the wall, and I break a chair over his head. We head for the border. There is a gorge with only a plank across it. A rock falls from above toward me. Mike stops it somehow. I feel the presence of my father, and I'm terrified. As I start to walk the plank, a helicopter lands. I know it's my father because I see his feet. The plank is slanted, and I start to slip. Mike helps me. I say, I'll just fall into the gorge and swim. That's okay. But really, I think I'll die when I fall. And I think that's just okay. Then we go on and reach the border. Mike says you have to run 30 more yards or more after you cross. You can't just slip across. I see buses crossing the border freely. Guards begin to shoot at us. I keep running and running, and they keep shooting. I crawl, gasping, up an incline, pulling on a railing. Mike says we're now at 40,000 feet. I can look down and see clouds. I'm petrified by the height. Mike says to come on. I'm uncertain of what to do. It's a really long dream. His first reaction to this dream was a sigh of relieved exhaustion at telling me, and a sense of awe and amazement at the spectacle of it. Bill said he hadn't known he had such strange and intense images inside him. He'd never had such a dream. He didn't remember dreams at all from childhood. In addition, there was a lot of anxiety as he told the dream and as we talked about it, but no depression. It was alive. He was alive as he talked about it. Some of his own associations, his verbal associations, said, I've always wanted to go to China, but never traveled much. Hong Kong is very modern, but Red China seems dangerous. Anything could happen. In addition, there was a lot of anxiety as he told the dream and as we talked about it, but no depression. It was alive. He was alive as he talked about it. Some of his own associations, his verbal associations, said, I've always wanted to go to China, but never traveled much. Hong Kong is very modern, but Red China seems dangerous. Anything could happen to you there. My backpacking as a scout was one of my few good experiences with groups of guys. The whole thing seems like an endurance contest. The bulls have great power. They stand out over everything. They are unworldly and sort of eerie. The last part of the dream seems like I'm just frantically running away, sort of out of control, and only get saved by Mike. My father is as frightening to deal with as when he was alive. I used to call my home a mausoleum. Maybe that has something to do with the sarcophagus. This is a long, complex dream, and I will only touch on the points of immediate relevance. First of all, recall the black hole and how it was such a primal entity it could only be minimally articulated. It seemed close to the raw energy at the core of life that can create or destroy, the creative unknown. This is the first dream Bill had reported with significant affective and symbolic dimensions. What struck me in the dream, among other things, was a sense of barely contained energies, as if a great barrier has been breached with nearly overwhelming forces erupting now into Bill's conscious mind. Their movements into new territory, then down into the earth, followed by a violent, almost out of control counter-reaction. There was a seesaw feeling typical of such situations when energies are released into the mind that are almost uncontainable. In the past, I've called this a whooshing feeling, and that's the way it feels. Just it's the force of the black hole which is seeking a voice and image. Of course, this strongly contrasted with the conventional Christianity of Bill's upbringing. There had not been room in his consciousness for such a force. He had identified with a sort of collective Christian goodness, partly in reaction to his father's turbulent alcoholic presence. Not being in touch with such vital parts of self, he had unconsciously found them and succumbed to them in his wife. These powerful energies were now appearing in differentiated symbolic form. Bill was beginning to claim them a bit as his own. In fact, and this is very important, the black hole never reappeared in any formidable way after this dream. The energy was now in a different, at a different level. This is a cogent example of psychic transformation and the movement of psychic energy from one level to another. This occurs in an ongoing way every day, so long as one is not stagnant and defended. Little elements of the unknown appear as emotion, symptoms, or difficulty in relationship. Ordinarily, our dreams and automatic right brain thinking just processes them. We only bother to think about them more intentionally when we can't avoid it because they cause overt disruptions that we can't avoid. The evolutionary spirit seeks incarnation. We may know it through small bits of terror or dread like fears in the dark. The energy is dark, but paradoxically seeks to evolve. We, our spirit, and our fantastic brains are the transformers and agents of evolution. In a way, we are used, but this is part of our humanity. Jung once said aptly, "Freedom consists in doing gladly that which one must do." So far as Bill himself was concerned, the possibility of further personal development and a deeper humanity were now there. The black hole had become a voyage into the earth where there were signs of death, but also bulls with red horns. It's a common motif to find the place of life near the place of death. Facing our dread and terror opens the way to new life by reducing our defenses. That is the bath of sulfuric acid that the alchemists were talking about, which is part of the process of transformation. The place of death is also the place where one finds the bull's vitality. This powerful animal is an ancient symbol of the power of the earth, a masculine force that is close to the mother. Being a mother's son, that was quite appropriate for Bill. The bull's horns were red. Red is the passion of life, life's blood, the sanguine temperament. In Roman times, the bull was slain by the sun hero Mithra and its blood drunk in a sort of communion. This may be the reason the communion ritual, for the communion ritual in Christianity, or at least why it was so readily accepted in the Roman Empire, because of the Mithraic mystery cult. In the dream, Bill wants to take a picture of the bulls. This shows an intention to preserve the connection, to take it with him and have it available for reflection over time. That is a way we learn to truly think and become conscious. He had a hard time containing his urine. He wants to get rid of some of the potent intensity of his experience. Bare-breasted women may bring up the possibility of a more nourishing relationship with his inner depths as well as with real relationships. He discovers he is ready to violently defend his right to that. This is part of the burgeoning red power of the bull. This animal vitality contrasts greatly with the conventional Catholic morality of Bill's past. Father appears as a threat from above. Is he going to remain under Father's heel? Or, on the other hand, does he need the Father's energy to keep himself under control? He almost loses it as he tries to cross back to the land of the familiar with his experiences. There are companions, and one especially faithful and reliable one. There was no real Mike. Mike seemed to represent the holding, guiding, and containing aspects of the therapeutic relationship. The ego and not the superego. An accessible masculine energy. This and the analytic container enabled him to endure what he most likely couldn't have on his own. The structures of Bill's personal self alone were not strong enough to have contained these energies within him. Passionate entitlement has its downside, but when a person has too little of it, life seems pale and joyless. Deep within, such individuals feel they deserve nothing. And they must always put up with the starvation diet. Psychic deadness is a common experience for them. Since they cannot tolerate acknowledgement of their true needs, they tend to manipulate others to provide the missing parts of themselves. And this is what Bill had done for much of his life. They harbor deep resentment and envy of those who are more real. As they age, they usually become more and more negative and bitter. This, hopefully, was not to be Bill's fate. Bill, like all of us, had a choice in that respect. He had found the energy of the bulls with the red horns. He was on the verge of consciously fighting for what was rightfully his inwardly and outwardly. And tomorrow in the workshop, I have a whole subsequent series of dreams to trace his development after this dream. So to conclude, Bruno Klaus and Bill both illustrate the evolution of life out of core of darkness. Bruno Klaus experienced an enigmatic face inspiring terror. Bill had a black hole that for a long time he only saw as horrifyingly destructive. The place of life is the place of the dark unknown, which may seem like death. Both men had to work to differentiate the deepest energies of life. Bruno Klaus became a hermit with profound healing powers and ministered to the spiritually and physically needy and to the larger community. Bill was on the road to having a more fulfilled life. He was beginning to integrate new emotions and undertake the slow work of refining these into humanly related feelings, creating the possibility of a changed relationship to self and to world. Such a process would take more time and deep commitment. Dreams epitomize human evolution and creativity. The energy of life has to undergo a journey toward consciousness that often begins in terrifying emotions, goes through primitive and then more complex symbolic forms, eventually becoming available to conscious life and thought. In the creation of consciousness, dreams are in between sheer darkness and consciousness. They reveal their meanings rather reluctantly, and relationship and commitment are required to humanize them. Every day we know little emotional perturbations, but we tend to ignore them. Times of crisis and transition may dramatically disrupt our comfortable habits. At times, they both frighten us and open new possibilities for being. We do have choices between evolving or becoming thwarted people in whom life has gone sour. Not too long before he died, Jung discussed old age. This is in Man and His Symbols. He said the greatest danger was to fall into misoneism. I didn't know what that meant, so I looked it up. It is in the dictionary, and it means the fear or hatred of the new, misoneism. He said that's the greatest danger in old age, or any age, too. So that's the fate with which we struggle. The vital energy at our core is dark and often terrifying. We glimpse it at first only through a glass darkly. But with courage and persistence, we may indeed get to know it in its full, ever-renewing truth and more face to face. Thank you.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright CG Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.